This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Think of a typical manufacturing town in New England. Maybe you're picturing lots of old factories in a setting like Springfield, Vermont, or Lowell, Massachusetts. But if you're also thinking of empty brick buildings with broken windows, towns that have lost their vitality, and industries in decline, our guests today would like you to reconsider your interpretation of manufacturing. A new report commissioned by the New England Council makes the case for advanced manufacturing in this region, with an emphasis on attracting high-paying, safe jobs in technologically advanced fields like aerospace, biotechnology, and defense. But the challenge will be training a workforce so these manufacturers can build and grow in New England, and convincing young people that they want a job in advanced manufacturing. So let's hear the case, and we'll talk about the potential challenges and pitfalls. We are joined now by Pat Moulton, Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Hello again, Secretary Moulton. Nice to talk with you.
Good afternoon, Jane. It's great to be here.
So we're hoping to get on a guest who can talk a little bit about a report that was just commissioned by the New England Council to look at advanced manufacturing throughout New England and make the case. But the state of Vermont actually did just such a report about Vermont a couple of years ago now. I'd love for you to start by talking a little bit about how important manufacturing is to the Vermont economy.
Happy to. We did a report in January of 2013 on advanced manufacturing here in Vermont, and it paralleled a national effort that President Obama had launched looking at advanced manufacturing nationwide. But for Vermont, the data I can quote you from 2013 indicates that we have over 1,000 firms engaged in manufacturing, most of those advanced manufacturing, and most of them small, with about 60% having fewer than 10 employees and 87% having fewer than 50 employees. And that manufacturing currently employs over 31,000 people here in Vermont with an average wage, which I think is an important thing to keep in mind, that's 36% above the statewide average wage for all earnings, or an average of approximately $51,000, and contributing over almost $3 billion to the Vermont economy. And that multiplier effect of that contribution to the Vermont economy is huge. And so it's a big deal for us here in Vermont.
Secretary Moulton, you mentioned 30-some-odd thousand Vermonters who are engaged in jobs in manufacturing. And to put that into perspective, that's more than 10% of our job force, right? I mean, this is the largest sector outside of state government?
That's my understanding, yes.
So can you give me some examples of the kinds of firms you're talking about?
Well, I can talk about companies such as GW Plastics, that's based in Bethel and Royalton, Vermont, that they do precision plastic injection molding for healthcare and other fields, and grew up here in Vermont, literally. Fred Reel, predecessor to the current president, Ben Reel, helped start that company literally in an old barn in Bethel. But now they're dealing with machinery that is of extremely advanced technology, all computer operated. They're using computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing to design and build these firms, or these products rather. When you walk in their plant, and this January we had the opportunity to tour GW in Royalton with the House Commerce Committee of the Vermont Legislature, and I can honestly say the members of the committee, I think, were terribly impressed with the technology that was there, the cleanliness of the workplace, the professional aspect of the workplace. I mean, you could literally eat off the floor. It was bright. It was colorful. Yet very clearly, a lot of very smart people who are very technically inclined, who are employed there as technicians and engineers. And Mack Molding and Arlington is another example, GS Precision in Brattleboro, Biotech, Logic Supply. The names go on and on of the types of companies that are using advanced technology and the latest technology to produce products, and continually in a place of innovation around those products, which are continuing to put out great new products and evolve the needs of their workforce.
So maybe you can help me understand a little bit better, because, you know, I mentioned that people might have an idea about what manufacturing is. Can you describe exactly how we define advanced manufacturing and how that's different?
Well, I think the definition of advanced manufacturing may vary depending on who you ask. And I know hopefully the folks from Deloitte will be on to discuss their definition. But it really is when you're using new technology and innovation in the way you produce products. Let's bring it to something that one may never consider advanced manufacturing, and it may not be in the technical definition, but even farming. Back in the day when we were milking cows, we had hand milkers, then we had vacuum milkers. We now have robotic robots that milk cows. I mean, that's an advanced technology. It's a very simple definition, but in the case, and I understand you're going to have Bob Zider of Vermont Manufacturing Extension Center call in, he can probably give you another definition. But it really is the use of the latest technologies and the innovation around those technologies that are employed in how you produce a product. And then there's a constant evolution of that production capability.
We're talking today about advanced manufacturing. Listeners, it is more than 10% of the workforce in Vermont who's engaged in this kind of work. So if you are among them, you want to share your definition of what advanced manufacturing is or what your job is like, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's bring in here Allison Lands. She's senior manager for Deloitte Consulting, and she's co-author and editor of a new report that looks at how New England can attract high-paying jobs in advanced manufacturing and sort of sets out the landscape for New England. Allison, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being here. Oh, we're still working on getting Allison. So, Pat Moulton, as you said, you think this is something that is difficult to define exactly, but we are talking about jobs that are involved in technological fields that have a lot of precision. Why are they so much more high-paying than the average Vermont salary, but also perhaps than the old traditional manufacturing jobs?
Well, because of that technology piece, Jane, because the processes have evolved so much, it isn't a matter of, number one, you've always needed to know math and have good mathematical skills to be involved in manufacturing. But we've gone from the slide rule, if you will, to the computer, from the drafting table to the computer-aided design. And therefore, you have to have those advanced computer skills. You need advanced mathematics. And because you need that additional education, you can command the higher wage. Likewise, the product is selling at a higher price and margins are improving, we hope, as productivity is being gained within the manufacturers that are producing these products. So the best resource that any manufacturer has is their employee. And to retain and attract those employees, you need good wages, good benefits, and advanced manufacturing has those wages, pays those kinds of wages, offers those kind of benefits to retain their best resource, which are their people. And we've heard that from company after company here in Vermont is my people are my best resource. I have to pay them well. I have to offer good benefits to keep them, but that they're also struggling finding those skills, those math skills and those technical skills that they need to be to stay in the forefront of their industry sector.
Now we are going to try going to Allison Lands. She's senior manager for Deloitte Consulting. And as I said, Deloitte was charged with putting out a report charged by the New England Council on the landscape for advanced manufacturing in New England. I believe we have Allison on the line now. Are you there, Allison? Thanks for joining us.
Yes, I am.
Oh, fabulous.
Thank you for having me on the show. I'd echo some of the comments that were just made about the higher than average wages that are commanded by advanced manufacturing occupations and the emphasis on people. Deloitte has done both this study with the New England Council as well as a kind of companion study with the Manufacturing Institute both in the first quarter of this year. And we identified that at present there are approximately 18,000 vacant positions in advanced manufacturing across the New England region, positions that are open and in search of a talented worker, but the volume of workers across the region and folks with the right set of skills and capabilities, those advanced capabilities that were just mentioned, don't currently exist to fill those positions. So in some respects, it's an issue of productivity and it's an issue of you know, advanced skill sets, and it's also an issue of supply and demand.
Well, and that's the rub, isn't it, Allison? I mean, that's what you found, was that the number one issue for employers was finding a skilled workforce to do the jobs that they say they have ready and open and want to fill.
Absolutely. Over the next 10 years, the Manufacturing Institute crunched some data, and the projections were across New England, there will be over 100,000 vacant positions in search of workers. And with respect to Vermont, we extrapolated those numbers down, and it's in the neighborhood of 5,500 jobs, and those 5,500 jobs paying above average wages, as we mentioned just before.
So, Pat Moulton, we're going to get into this a little deeper in just a few minutes, but do you think it's the state of Vermont's job, then, to be training a workforce for these specific jobs? Do we need to have a sort of a global thinking in how we educate people, or are you looking at advanced manufacturing and saying this is an important enough sector that we want to train directly to that specific industry?
Absolutely, Jane. It is an important sector for us here in Vermont, but the caveat I would have is that you can't easily, quote unquote, train for these jobs. You need to educate for these jobs. These are not the kinds of things that generally that you can put somebody through an 8-week training program and expect that they're going to have the proficiency to advance throughout their career. This really is about making sure our K through 16 education system provides adequate science, technology, engineering, and math, with a strong emphasis on math, for our kids as they're going to school, so that we can create the pipeline that's going to feed these businesses into the future. So, yes, it's important enough for us here in Vermont to invest in the training and the education, and our agency has the Vermont Training Program, where we are able to come in and look at cross-training as well as bringing people into entry-level jobs and providing the kinds of training that they need to do. The Department of Labor has the Workforce Education and Training Fund and the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Funds from the federal government to help train people. But in most cases, those hard-to-fill jobs of engineering and technicians require more than just a training program. You need advanced math in high school, and in some cases, to go on for some college beyond high school, 2-year associate's degree or certifications. And in a lot of cases, you need a bachelor's degree. But it isn't always the bachelor's degree that's needed. But you do need a good, strong basis in math. And so that's why we spend a lot of time trying to talk about STEM skills here in Vermont and trying to help our students understand the importance and the opportunities available to them with a strong base in STEM.
Allison Lanz, is that an issue across the country, or is New England unique in finding that it lacks people with those STEM skills?
I'd say it's not unique to Vermont, and I'd say it's probably not unique to New England either. The crux of the issue for New England, I think, is that given the strong historical background of manufacturing in this region, the fact that over time, through improvements in technology and production processes, this agglomeration economy, or a very powerful network of talented businesses, premier educational institutions and academic infrastructure, has built up a capacity here in New England where it's globally competitive with respect to advanced manufacturing and innovations in that field. So the talent shortage, I think, can be felt even more acutely because so many of the smaller and medium-sized manufacturers, the folks who feed the global supply chain, are located within this region. And when they suffer for talent, it's not just the small and medium-sized business that suffers. It's actually the region and the larger anchor employers within the region that suffer. One of the issues I think that was just touched upon was, connecting with students when they're still in that K through 16 pipeline. And one of the interesting findings that we found when we were conducting the study with the New England Council was that, many students are not realizing the opportunities that are available in this field and are in fact being dissuaded from STEM fields, from advanced manufacturing careers and career pathways as early as middle school or high school age, which is kind of just the time when you're wanting to really harness their energy and direct it towards STEM capabilities and skill sets. And so I think rebranding the industry as something that is growing, has momentum, and is this kind of technology-driven, clean industry, not the factory job of decades past, is really going to be critical to, you know, capturing the hearts and minds of the millennial workers and those in the generations beyond.
We are talking about advanced manufacturing today. We've been learning a little bit about what kinds of industries are included in that term, advanced manufacturing, and why Labor Department officials are trying to educate Vermonters on what they see as the upsides to jobs in this field. We've been looking very specifically at the need for more STEM education. Coming up, we're going to talk with somebody who works at the Vermont Manufacturing Extension Center, the director of that center, to talk about, okay, so how do we educate people into these jobs that are here and open? We're also going to talk about that issue of maybe kids being turned off by this kind of job. Deloitte and the Manufacturing Institute found in a survey that from 18 to 24-year-olds, they rank manufacturing dead last among the industries in which they would choose to start a career. We're also going to talk about, okay, so maybe the companies themselves need to be having internship and apprenticeship programs, and are we seeing that happening? And we'd love to hear from you, listeners, if you find yourself working in these fields or if you have questions for Secretary Moulton or for Allison Lands with Deloitte Consulting. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or share your experiences on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Pat Moulton is Vermont's Commerce Secretary. Allison Lands is Senior Manager for Deloitte Consulting, which just came out with a new report that looks at how New England can attract and retain high-paying jobs in advanced manufacturing. And that's what we're discussing today. If you have a question about why the New England states might want to work hard to entice these kinds of companies or to train workers, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. If you work in advanced manufacturing, we'd love to hear from you. Describe your job. Help us understand what this field is all about. We have with us now on the line Bob Zeider. He's director and CEO of the Vermont Manufacturing Extension Center. VMEC is located in Randolph. And since we've been talking about this issue of companies saying they can't find trained workers locally to do the jobs that they have open, let's hear from Bob about what he's doing. Nice to have you on the program, Bob.
Thank you for having me on.
So explain what the skills are exactly that you are teaching people.
Well, let me point out we do more than just training. Primarily, we work in the area of implementing systems and solutions with manufacturers across the state. But obviously, as we've been talking, the workforce issue is one of the top three issues that we continually run into, and it is a real constraint in the growth of manufacturing in our state. So generally, we offer a number of public workshops and so forth that address particular technical skills and so forth that are becoming more commonplace in the world of manufacturing. They weren't when we opened our center 20 years ago, but they've really become mainline things like lean manufacturing, both from the floor all the way through the front office, and critical thinking skills, basic problem-solving skills, tools that are sort of within that lean manufacturing toolbox, we call it. So there's things like setup reduction, visual systems, and so forth. So these are basic concepts and principles for continuous improvement that manufacturers can and really must implement on their shop floors and throughout their enterprise these days to really remain competitive on the world stage. And the reality is, whereas 20 years ago we were not really competing as much globally, today we are. And the internet has changed the world dramatically, made it very flat. So it's a whole new ball game, and we need to be continuously improving our processes, and with that, the skill sets of our people. So the types of people that we need today in an advanced manufacturing company are people that have critical thinking skills, folks that are involved and are interested in innovating. We're talking about millennials. I think that as we begin to deal with the workforce, and now I understand millennials have just crossed over. They are the majority of the workforce now. Those are the folks basically between the age of 18 and 34. The baby boomers, as we know, are rapidly exiting. And I don't know what happened to the X generation, but they're sort of moving aside. And so we have this Y generation. They really looked at the world quite differently. So I think that's a component as we look at training the workforce that we also need to consider.
So you at VBank work with, I mean, as you said, it's not just training workers. I mean, you all work all the way up to working with the CEOs of companies.
That's correct.
I mentioned just before we went to the break, you know, one of the questions about, okay, if companies can't find the skilled workers and they can't get enough of them through programs that are run by Vermont schools or people who are being trained by you, Are there enough apprenticeship programs? I mean, should companies be doing the training themselves from start to finish, basically?
Well, I think yes. I think this really, at the end of the day, has to be a partnership. There's no one silver bullet, and we just can't stand in a circle and point at one another and say, it's your job, it's your job, it's my job. And so really we need the partnerships of state government, of the private sector, of the educational community, working together on this. And we need more applied learning opportunities, internships, high school through college, paid internships are more ideal, obviously. We need to get back, I think, personally, to more of a mentoring mentality as well. There are just some things after you've taught these basic skills that I mentioned that really you need that one-on-one face time with individuals to pass on the knowledge and the skills that history there that has to go with the particular job and how they approach their job. So we need more STEM opportunities, I think, between K to 12, working with STEM employers. And once again, Pat mentioned earlier the GW Plastics. They've got an innovative program going with Vermont Technical College that also involves Randolph Union High School. And so they're working together cooperatively with paid internships, ultimately leading to an associate's degree. And so these are the kinds of innovative approaches that really need to be in more in play. Frankly, I'll be candid, I think we have plenty of resources in our state, educationally and so forth. I think we really need to work together more cooperatively, more creatively, more innovatively, and target those. And then I think we can begin to really begin to put a real dent in the problem that we have.
Bob, while you say you're speaking frankly, and just before I let you go, I'll pose this to Allison Lanz and Pat Moulton as well. But we got a note from Scott in Stowe who says, look, lower the cost of doing business and living in Vermont. Stop punishing companies for setting up shop here with high taxes and fees. Get taxes under control so income and property taxes aren't so high for the employers. The wage earners have been leaving in droves because of this, yet Montpelier refuses to reduce spending. This doesn't just apply to manufacturing companies. It's business and employment in general for the entire state. From your perspective, Bob, do you agree?
Well, that's a tough question to answer in just a couple of sound bites, quite frankly, because there's a lot of elements that go into that. But I would say this. When you have a rising tide, it lifts all boats. And when our companies are able to truly be competitive on the world stage, when they have a pipeline of innovative products where they are able to have good profits and good profit margins, they will make the investments when they can, I believe, in their workforce, and they'll have to retain the workers. The reality is that the global competition has been so stiff, and we have a lot of companies that have really found themselves slipping down the slide into commodity hell, where they're just continually working on cutting their costs, cutting, rather than looking at ways they can really grow their top-line growth with profitable new products and services, different business models, and so forth. So we need growth. We need to grow the revenue, grow the company profits, and I think then we will see more investments follow and be able to hopefully have that rising tide.
Bob Zeider is director and CEO of the Vermont Manufacturing Extension Center. VMEC is located in Randolph. Bob, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And we are talking about advanced manufacturing today. Right now we're looking at perhaps what the state could or should do to make it a more friendly climate for these companies to come in, set up shop, do business. And if you want to weigh in with your thoughts or your experiences, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or call 1-800-639-2211. We're going to be hearing about a program at Vermont Technical College in just a moment, too. But Allison Lanz, let me ask you, I mean, you found in your report that looks at New England and manufacturing. New England, it's pretty well known, has a higher cost of living than some other parts of the country. So is that a downfall for the future of attracting these kinds of high-paying, technologically advanced companies to our region?
Well, I'll say that I got to echo Bob's statement about a rising tide lifting all boats. You know, across the New England spectrum, each state that we spoke to had its own challenges with respect to the cost of doing business and business regulation, and it varies from state to state. As a region, it does make New England a bit of a higher cost, and we've seen that reflected in other states in regions throughout the Southeast and Midwest approaching businesses in the New England corridor to try to entice them to, you know, relocate or expand their business outside the region. Now, that said, you know, that's kind of a scary, you know, prospect that I just identified. But having said that, the response from the New England businesses has been, in general, I really can't afford to locate my business outside of this New England corridor because the innovation network here is so strong. The access to talent here is so plentiful, you know, relatively speaking, even though I know we just talked about job vacancies. You know, they're able to get the highest caliber of talent and have access to, you know, a broad, diverse group of suppliers and innovators to feed their business model that locating outside the region at this point still doesn't make sense. That said, the region that moves first on building up the skills of their workforce and starting to get that viable pool of talented, educated, STEM-educated graduates who are ready to work and have the soft skills that Bob talked about is going to experience a significant increase in their competitive advantage across the advanced manufacturing spectrum.
Okay, so Pat Moulton, I'll finally let you weigh in here as well when you think about ways that the state can perhaps just smooth the path a little bit. I mean, you look at things like how you tax companies and what the tax categories are, and maybe they need to shift a little bit, or changing labor laws to incorporate things like apprenticeships and internships for young people who might have difficulty doing that under laws that we have in place. So what do you see as ways that the state can contribute in a positive way that isn't just throwing money at these particular industries and companies?
Well, I would start by echoing Allison's last comment about the place that wins the workforce race, if you will, and probably that's a bad way to characterize it, is going to be more successful. And we're a small state in Vermont, and we feel pretty strongly that we should be able to win that challenge of filling our pipeline with good technically trained people. So and we're finding more and more when site selectors are talking to companies, workforce is really one, if not number one, then number two on the question of where they will locate. Where can I find a qualified workforce? And taxes rank somewhere lower down the list. And I know for us as individuals, taxes may rank a little bit higher, but we also need to look at how competitive we are. And in Vermont, I mean, certainly, you know, Governor Shumlin was advocating pretty heavily we need to cut costs, not raise taxes. And in this last legislative session and the last couple sessions, we've done some things to help improve the tax climate here in Vermont. For example, we do not tax machinery and equipment used in the manufacturing process. And we expanded that definition a couple of years ago. We were able this year to get some changes through on the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive that will open that incentive program up to more companies. We've had Efficiency Vermont and utilities like Green Mountain Power that have been working very closely with our manufacturers to bring down the cost of power. And we've done things like small business offering exemptions to help those kinds of firms, the small and medium-sized starting up firms, have greater access to capital. So we've done a lot of those things, and we're always looking for more. I mean, this is, as Bob says, the rising tide raises all the boats, and so we want to see new economic activity generated or new income to the state generated through new economic activity. And that's really where a lot of the focus is. But it really, I believe, does start with that workforce, the education. How well are we doing at preparing our kids for opportunities in this field? And how well are we doing at retraining adults who may need to make a career change? And that's what we're pretty heavily focused on. And I just want to go back to something that you had talked about a little bit earlier, in terms of this isn't your father's manufacturing and the image of manufacturing. I did economic development in Springfield, Vermont, which is the machine tool capital of literally the world at one point. But you had a lot of parents when that industry started to recede and jobs started to disappear, discouraging their kids from going into the machine tool business because they felt there was no opportunity. Now in Springfield, throughout Vermont, throughout New England, we're screaming for machinists because those machinists need that strong STEM basis. And I looked just this morning, I was with ROV Technologies. It's recently been purchased by Rolls-Royce Nuclear Services. They build robots that go into nuclear power plants. They build them, they deploy them. And the CFO of the company explained to be proficient at deploying and using this equipment, it's like using an Xbox or a PlayStation. So young people are really proficient at operating their robots. I've heard that with several other companies who said, look, the operating panel for this machine here is just like an Xbox. So I think people need to understand that it is not your father's manufacturing more. It's not slimy and grimy. So kids have got to open up their opportunity. Parents have got to realize that it's not what it once was and that there are tremendous opportunities. I boast about my nephew who graduated from college into a $50,000 a year as a mechanical engineer, into a good job that's only paying him more the longer he's there. These are great opportunities for young people, but we've done a poor job, I think, at helping people understand that while they're still in school and creating those experiential learning opportunities.
Well, speaking of school, we have Dr. John Kidder who's called in. He's the chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering Technology at Vermont Technical College. Dr. Kidder, thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts here as you listen?
Well, thank you for having me. I was calling just to make a couple different comments. One was, and I was echoing some things I think that were just said, really advanced manufacturing. I found it interesting when you guys were talking about the definition of advanced manufacturing. And it's really the advent of automation and cheap computers, microcontrollers. These days, elementary school kids can buy Arduinos and build robots, and that very inexpensive automation is sort of the common thread, I think, that falls through all of this, and that then defines the kinds of skills sometimes you need. But I was also calling to say, to make a little bit of a plug for my college, we're starting a new Bachelor's of Science in Manufacturing, so this resonates with some other comments that have been made. We have a Bachelor's of Science in Manufacturing that's enrolling this fall, and we designed it to be flexible and accessible, so we actually have a cohort of traditional students transferring in as juniors. We also have a cohort of people that are going to be taking the course while they're working at GE Rutland, the GE Aviation in Rutland. So we're pretty excited about that, and we're, like I said, we've tried to make the program accessible. Much like Bob Zider was commenting, it's important to make these things accessible where people can get credit for things they've done. So I actually have a meeting with Bob tomorrow to talk about things like, you know, how could we work in workshops that VMEC gives to count towards a college degree like that, and we're upgrading our labs. So we're very excited about this, and I would also echo that the companies need people. This program is built off of the foundation of things like apprenticeship programs that we've had with GE and GW Plastics and other places, and they are really looking for skilled labor, and they see the age of their workforce, and they have the ability to expand if they could get a good pipeline. And they're being, particularly GW Plastics, is being very proactive, and GE are being very proactive about building that pipeline.
Well, that's a good way to end it, as we've been talking here about what needs to happen in the educational sectors and how this all fits together. That's John Kidder. He's Department Chair for Mechanical Engineering Technology at Vermont Technical College. We've also been talking with Pat Moulton, Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, and Allison Land, Senior Manager for Deloitte Consulting in New York City. She's co-author and editor of a new report that looks at how New England can attract high-paying jobs in advanced manufacturing. That was commissioned by the New England Council, and the New England Council will be at the State House next Tuesday, June 9th, to discuss the report and to get input from Vermont's manufacturing community and state government officials. Allison Lands, Pat Moulton, thank you both very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up, posters advertising what's being called an ethnic blood drive in Winooski have raised some eyebrows. We're going to get an explanation from the head of blood services for the Red Cross in northern New England and find out why the organization says a diverse blood supply is scientifically advantageous. That's coming up on Vermont Edition. On Saturday, June 6th, the American Red Cross is holding a blood drive in Winooski. That doesn't sound like news. Blood drives are a pretty common occurrence. But the flyers advertising this particular blood drive have raised some eyebrows because the event is being called an ethnic diversity blood drive, raising the question, what exactly does the Red Cross mean by ethnic blood? Joining me now is Dr. Jorge Rios, the medical director of the American Red Cross Blood Services for most of New England. He oversees all Red Cross activities around blood drives and blood supply in our region. Dr. Rios, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good morning.
The flyer in question states that, quote, the American Red Cross encourages eligible donors of all races and ethnicities to give blood or platelets in support of a diverse blood supply. Can you explain why the Red Cross has an interest in a diverse blood supply?
Well, the blood type is determined by our genes that we get from our father and our mother, and most likely in the color of our eyes or our hair. Now, there's differences in the genes that we inherit. So therefore, we need donors of all ethnicities to come and give blood for us to be able to find rare units and be able to give blood to patients who need rare blood types.
You know, when we think about blood types, we think about A, B, and O. So when you're saying that people have different blood types, you're not talking about A, B, and O, or, you know, AB or O negative. You're talking about some of the antigens in the blood?
Right. So blood can be classified according to the ABO system and the Rh system. But there are other antigens or classification systems in science.
And the Rh system is related to whether you're a positive or a negative.
That's correct. And therefore, some patients become sensitized to the blood of a particular donor. And once they become sensitized, we need to provide them with more compatible units that will come from somebody who is ethnically and racially similar to them. So therefore, we ask any volunteer donor to give us their race and ethnicity. We'll have that in the database. And we could, you know, find their units and find if they're compatible with that patient's blood.
Can you describe some of the antigens that are more prevalent in certain blood types than in others?
I think the most common are the DOFI A and DOFI B. African Americans lack those antigens, so they become sensitized when they get transfusions sometimes. And after they become sensitized, we need to provide what we call DOFI A and DOFI B negative blood, and that will come from somebody from the same race, another African-American donor.
And you're saying Duffy A and Duffy B blood? I'm not familiar with Duffy. What is it?
It's one of the multiple antigens or proteins in the red cells, the cells that carry oxygen from the lungs to the organs in the body. And there's about 600 antigens and classification, let's say, families. So one of them is called the Duffy. And as I mentioned before, African-Americans lack the Duffy A and Duffy B antigen. When they get blood from people from other races, they become sensitized. And at that point, we need to give them racially identical blood.
So Vermont and Northern New England generally is a region that's overwhelmingly Caucasian. Does that mean that the blood supply in this region also lacks diversity?
It doesn't mean that. It means that we really need people to give us that information so we're able to find compatible units. And this does happen all the time, that we need to find rare units. It's almost on a daily basis, but not for the majority of the patients. So therefore, we need any kind of blood donor. But for some of them, if they lack these certain proteins or antigens, the match between their transfusions and the patient getting the transfusion will be, you know, most ideal.
Sure, but in this case, in this blood drive, the Red Cross is specifically reaching out and asking people of all ethnicities to right. donate blood. So there's at least an appearance that there is a need for or a lack of diverse blood in Vermont.
Well, I think that's a problem across the nation. You know, I do recognize that the donor pool could be more diversified. And any effort to increase the donor pool and increase the number of donors of all races, you know, will be most beneficial. Some of these antigens are also more present in Caucasian donors. So it doesn't mean that Caucasian donors, their blood cannot be used for special situations. It could also be used for special situations.
Is the blood supply that is donated in Northern New England kept in Northern New England, or is it transported all over the country?
We supply the needs of our local hospitals first, and any excess inventory we share across the nation. Remember, there could be bad weather, you know, here, for example. Or let's say in Texas this week, you know, it's raining there, people are not giving blood, and they need transfusions. So we could send blood across the nation if needed for emergencies. But our mission is to supply the local needs first.
I want to go back to this flyer. The idea of ethnic or racial profiling of blood raises some uncomfortable memories of segregated blood supplies. And for that reason, the flyer really raised eyebrows. It also didn't help that the word ethnic was misspelled on the flyers that we saw. One person who objected was Keisha Rahm, who works for the city of Burlington and is a state lawmaker. Rahm doesn't argue with the science that you've described or even the motivation of holding a blood drive like this, but she has a big problem with how this blood drive has been presented locally. Here's why she thinks the flyer is a problem.
Making generalizations about people having different types of blood is not an okay road to go down. You know, there are people who are still alive who are part of bad science, bad social experiments, and a dark time when people were making scientific arguments for differences between us as humans. And that instantly takes people back to that place who remember it. And for everybody else, it just doesn't honor the sophistication and the level of knowledge of people when you're asking for very specific needs in your blood supply.
Dr. Rios, I know that you didn't make this particular local flyer, but how do you respond to that?
What I'd like to say is that every 2 seconds, somebody needs blood in the U.S., and the mission of the Red Cross is to provide that blood to the patient. So if by doing this blood drive, we could get more blood donors of all races and ethnicities, able to fulfill the needs of those patients, you know, were mostly satisfied about the donor's generosity. That's my response.
Yeah, but that doesn't address the question of how it comes across to the people that you're trying to reach out to. This idea of an ethnic blood drive spells fear or concern or anger in the very populations that you're trying to reach out to give blood, and doesn't explain why you actually need that blood.
And I want to say that the records are a non-discrimination policy, and we don't discriminate based on race or ethnicity among blood donors. Our ultimate aim is to find more donors. Only a third of the people are eligible to give blood, and only about 4% of the population actually give blood. So knowing that we need donors each and every day, whole blood donors and platelet donors, you know, any effort that we could do with the ultimate aim of getting more donors into the donor pool, first-time donors to give blood for the first time, we greatly appreciate it.
The science you described earlier in our conversation, I know it's very hard to get that across in a flyer that, you know, somebody's going to walk by and just glance at. But do you agree that the communication around this blood drive missed the mark?
No, I don't. You know, our efforts are correct. Our time to expand the donor pool, the need is constant. Every 2 seconds, somebody needs blood. And whatever we could do to increase the donor pool, it's advantageous for everybody, you know, especially the patients needing blood and the hospitals in Vermont.
Dr. Jorge Rios is the medical director of the American Red Cross Blood Services for most of New England. We've been discussing the science around ethnicity and blood supply, and what some people consider to be clumsy communication about an upcoming ethnic diversity blood drive. Dr. Rios, thank you very much for explaining the science and for your time.
You're welcome. Take care.
And the blood drive we've been discussing is being held in Winooski this Saturday. You can find details and learn more about the genetic markers in blood by visiting our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Now we turn to your comments, and I'm joined by managing producer Patty Daniels. Hey, Patty, get us rolling.
Hey, Jane. Well, many listeners, no surprise, had comments about Senator Bernie Sanders and the race for the presidency. Vermont's junior senator officially kicked off his campaign for the Democratic nomination in a big event in Burlington last week. Heather left this message on our Facebook page saying, "This is the first primary election with a candidate, Bernie Sanders, that I can vote for with complete support and confidence."
Jason in Fletcher wrote on why he doesn't want Sanders to win the primary. He says, "I want Bernie to stay in the race as long as possible so he can help drive the national conversation, particularly on topics related to income inequality. However, much like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie's voice is greatly needed in the Senate, where he can actually make a difference on all ranges of legislation. As we've seen since 2008, presidents are often powerless against Congress, and liberal voices like Bernie's are desperately needed to counteract the GOP-controlled Senate."
And Trey had thoughts that he wrote to us about our coverage. He says, your pregame show is great, but I must take issue with a commenter who intimated that Democrats would vote for Hillary to set the precedent of a woman president. That is seriously disingenuous. A sensible voter is going to look at a candidate with an unwavering historical support for issues over someone whose stance can be questioned.
Well, your comments weren't entirely Bernie related. In response to our recent show on why Vermont ranks at the bottom when it comes to participating in organized religion, Waze Woman posted, "I believe many people are giving up organized religion in favor of a personal spirituality. For example, I don't call myself a Christian anymore because I could no longer espouse the Apostles' Creed. That said, I believe in God. I've found wisdom in the teachings of Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad, and other spiritual figures. To me, organized religion is somewhat frightening, judgmental, exclusive, and oppressive. I no longer wish to be a part of it."
We also recently hosted a discussion about how television has changed over the decades, and in some cases, how it's taken on a level of ritual. And Michael posted, "Our family unplugged the TV 8 years ago, and we have never regretted the decision. While there is undoubtedly some entertaining and informative content on TV, on the whole, we felt it was too much temptation to simply veg out in the evening. We replaced our TV viewing with board games, Netflix, reading, and listening to VPR." Yay! "When my wife, a teacher, discussed the absence of a TV in our home with her grade school class, the consensus of the class was, 'How do you live?'"
Well, and after our summer book show last week, Jenny wrote in with one more late-breaking suggestion. She says, "Everyone should run out and read Jennifer Tseng's Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness." Now, that's a new novel set in